Okay. Ready to resume. The next item on our agenda is a discussion on the residential infill project. And we have some folks here. That's right. We have some folks from BPS who are here to talk about it.
I'm going to give a quick introduction.
And BDS.
Yes. For the record, Benjamin Nielsen, BDS. I just wanted to quickly go over, I sent you a memo kind of summarizing some of the revisions to the proposed draft that you received a staff report for. Hopefully you had a chance to dig into the actual proposed code. It was a pretty thick document, which is why you didn't get a copy, but the link was provided to see it on the internet. So the memo I sent you discussed some of the revisions and related those back to the memo that the Landmarks Commission sent to BPS for the last round back at the end of November 2017. So I just wanted to go through very quickly, just a couple slides talking about those issues, just to prompt some discussion from your end. So some of the items, or one of the items that the commission was concerned about with the discussion draft was the inclusion of preservation incentives for historic properties as opposed to just restrictions that could be added to preserve historic properties. And I think some of those concerns maybe have been addressed. In this proposed draft, there's flexibility in the allocation of FAR within the A overlay, which covers quite a few of our historic districts. So maximum FAR applies to the combined floor area of all structures on the site, which means the primary structure and all accessory structures. There have been provisions added prohibiting additional stories to be added to historic structures, increasing or replacing 50% or more of exterior wall area or any floor, on any floor, excuse me. And then there's still a provision in the code that the commission had some issues with, which was allowing the addition of up to 800 square feet of floor area or up to 100% increase of floor area in on historic structures, and commission thought that was much too large. And again, these incentives and restrictions are only applied to designated or inventoried historic structures, so that includes the HRI. There was a lot of talk about tuck under garages and also as a result of that, porch heights that are too high above the grade. There's been some slight tweaks to the standards that might result in some changes to how these tuck under garages might be developed. So while tuck under garages are still allowed, they're slightly less incentivized than they may have been before. Maximum height has been defined to be measured from the lowest point within 5 feet of the building at grade. So if you have a sunken driveway, that would be probably one of the lowest grades around the building. Maximum height remains at 30 feet in general for R7, R5, and R2.5 zoned lots. And that's only for detached structures in the R2.5 zone. However, the definition of floor area and therefore FAR does not include basements. And basement has been defined to allow 50% of the total combined area of the basement wall to be only partially below or at grade. So as long as more than 50% of the basement is below grade, that counts as a basement and does not count towards FAR. And then there's been a new restriction added to the elevation of a main entrance to a primary structure. And you can read that as the porch elevation must be within 4 feet above, no more than 4 feet above grade. And I should go back to the image here. This is a house that was recently constructed on Peacock Lane, which provides a pretty good example of a infill in a now new historic district with a tuck under garage. And I also wanted to show this example again, which you've seen in the past, both through the residential infill briefings we've had and through a land use appeal. Maybe it was actually a type 3 case, I can't recall now. But the building on the left was how the proposal came in with a tuck under garage, 3,300 square feet. That would be above what would be allowed through the proposed code. However, I wanted to show the relationship of that tuck under garage, the building height, and the height of the porch. Those are all basically what would still be allowed, it looks to some extent, with the proposed code, just for discussion.
Did that building get built, or is it under construction?
Don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think the one on the right is how it ended up, which is, you know, better detached garage set back behind the house. There was also a lot of talk about cottage clusters, which are a type of development that will be allowed through some provisions of the residential infill project. These would have to be approved through a plan development review, but there are no restrictions at present about whether these are allowed or not allowed within historic districts or other historic properties. And for reference, plan development reviews that include 11 or more units would be reviewed through a type 3 process that would go in front of the hearings officer and not the Design Commission or Landmarks Commission. And finally, accessory dwelling units. It's still allowed to have two accessory dwelling units in the A overlay zone. Those in historic districts or historic properties could be both internal to the house, or they could be both detached units. And I don't believe there's any restriction as to whether those have to be separate detached structures or if they could be one combined structure, except for a limit on building coverage for accessory structures at 15% of site area. So I just wanted to point that out. That was a concern the Landmarks Commission had back in November. And that's all I had to say. Hopefully it was accurate. We had some pretty quick turnaround times with this review and lots of other code reviews that are going on right now. So there's a lot going on at BDS and BPS. I'm sure Morgan and Brandon will correct me if I made any mistakes. But do you have any questions for me?
Quick question in regards to, I think, the first slide, if you could bring that back. Do you have any projects that come to mind where, while you're prohibited from adding a story, increasing or replacing 50% or more of the exterior wall area of on any floor? Have you guys ever approved a project like that on a landmark or a contributing resource?
None come to mind for me.
I'm sorry, a what? I was reading a work email, sorry.
It's okay. Have you ever approved a project through type 1 or type 2 as a staff that included, so a building didn't have a story added, but it increased or replaced 50% or?
In a residential district, I think the closest I can recall is that Dutch Colonial addition that Dave Skilton reviewed.
In Irvington, or is it?
Yeah.
Okay, but that would be the closest.
Yeah, and I don't think that that was actually 50%. I just think it was rather large.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to get a sense for what that would potentially look like.
Okay. I don't think we get many applications for an entire story to be added to a house, generally.
I can think of one. That would be, I think that's in Eastmoreland where they added like two stories to a house.
Oh, well, yeah,
it happens in Ladd's Addition a fair amount.
But that, you know, wasn't
at least it used
district.
To. They would come in and propose a whole new story and more than
I haven't been here as long as Hillary, so
I know that happened one time in South Portland, and if I may have blocked it from my memory, but I feel like I did review something like that in a conservation district.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Anyone else have any questions, or we're good? Okay.
Well, hello, and thank you for having me back. I'm Morgan Tracy with the Bureau of Planning Sustainability, and with me is Brandon Spencer Hartle. I'm the project manager for the Residential Infill Project, and I thought Ben's presentation is appropriate because it'll sort of key up the context of my presentation. I'm here basically to give you an update on our proposed draft, the Residential Infill Project proposed draft, and describe a few of the more substantial changes between the previous and the current drafts. And I also wanted to give an update on the process because tomorrow night, we will be briefing the Planning and Sustainability Commission. They will be holding two hearings in May on the 8th and the 15th. They will then hold a work session on May 22nd. We're planning on them deliberating, potentially voting on June 12th. And then we anticipate going to City Council by the end of the year. So we're talking about fall with an effective date as it gets approved, by March of 2019. It's just a sort of look into the future there. So in terms of the nature of the changes between the two drafts, the prior draft and this draft, there were numbers of changes we made in terms of the code and clarification of the intent and refining our purpose statements and those sorts of changes, but there were probably about 25 more substantive kind of policy kind of changes. I wanted to focus just on the four or five more relevant ones and then go back through the points that Ben was raising and see how they line up with your concerns. So most notably in the proposals for setbacks and building design, we were initially proposing that the 10-foot setback in R25 and R5 be increased to 15 feet. And we have since changed that to only increase the R5 setback to 15 feet. The R2.5 setback would stay at 10 feet. We made some modifications around the visibility standards. We heard some feedback about how even a single step prevents or is an impediment to access and mobility. So we've gone with a no-step entry requirement. And we've provided another option or alternative for accommodating turning radius within the bathroom. And just a heads up or a reminder, the visibility requirements are triggered when you have a third unit on your site. So the triplex on a corner, the duplex with an ADU, or the house with the second ADU. We also made some major changes in our affordability incentives. Previously we'd allowed for a fourth unit on any lot if all four of those units were affordable 80% MFI, a median family income. We have revised that now. Now there's a provision that allows a fourth unit and some additional floor area on a corner lot, so four units on a corner lot when the fourth unit is affordable. And second option is earning extra FAR, 0.1, FAR by providing one affordable unit or paying a fee in lieu to buy up square footage. The fee would be paid into a housing fund. And then I think also significantly we made changes in each of our project topics, you know, for scale of houses, additional housing types, and narrow lots. We changed the parking proposals. So for standard lots, a house, a duplex, or a triplex that's built anywhere in the city, not just single dwelling zones, on a lot that has alley access, there would be no parking required, but if parking was proposed, the access to that parking would have to be from an alley. So basically saying you don't have to have parking, but you can, and if you have parking, it's gonna come off the alley. For the A overlay, the additional housing types overlay, parking will not be required for the additional housing types, a house with two ADUs, a duplex with a ADU, or a triplex on a corner lot. And for narrow lots, I think this is rather relevant. Previously, we crafted an exception that's allowed for a tuck under garage. There were specific standards that had to be met on narrow lots. We've since reversed that direction, and we're not requiring parking, but parking and driveways will now be prohibited between the building and the street. So no garage on the front of the house, no parking, no driveway on the front of the house. There are options for providing shared driveways between the homes or on corner lots, parking to the back behind the house, but no parking between the building and the street, which is a fairly significant change. So the Historic Landmarks Commission sent us a letter in November with essentially six issues that were raised at that time. And I thought with Brandon's help, I would go through and provide a little feedback in response to those. The first had to do with creating additional incentives for properties that were older than 50 years, not necessarily quote unquote historic.
So I'll jump in and talk about two things that were expanded from where we were at in the discussion draft for historic resources. One has to do with parking, as Morgan already mentioned. Two have to do with ADUs. We are proposing for duplexes, triplexes, and houses that have two accessory dwelling units that no parking would be required on the site. So, for example, if you have a house in Irvington or a house in Coley neighborhood, designated or not, if you are adding an ADU to the basement and converting your historic garage into an ADU, we would waive the requirement for on-site parking. So taking what we had already done for historic, saying if you are taking advantage of one of these alternative housing types because of the difficulty of providing on-site parking, we would waive that requirement if a owner is so elected to do so. And the other piece is with accessory dwelling units. If you're putting your accessory dwelling unit in the basement of a house built five or more years before historic or not, that accessory dwelling unit can fill up the entire footprint of the basement. Today, there's a limitation on the size of ADUs, either 800 square feet or 75% of the building. You would be able to exceed that if you put your basement into use as an ADU. So you might get 1,000 or 1,200 square foot ADU if it's in the basement. That's resolving a problem that's occurred both in and out of historic districts where people are walling off sections of their basement to not be used to stay underneath that existing generally 800 square foot threshold. So that would be expanded to any building built five or more years ago. And I think the other piece too, you know, with the incentives concept, wanted to be deliberate about sort of what we were putting out there in terms of availability for existing resources and thinking about what criteria we would use to open up the door for incentives. And where we landed both in the discussion draft and in the proposed draft is for the ability to move around FAR within the site or to allow for two detached or two attached ADUs. We did want to limit that just to resources that are designated as historic resources or those that are determined significant on the inventory or given a ranking, rather than opening that up to everyone in the event that there are buildings that really we're not wanting to keep around as a community that don't have significance, that may be opportunities for redevelopment that don't meet that significance test. We've continued to keep that position while allowing the parking and the ADU flexibility ADU flexibility to existing buildings, parking to everybody.
Right. Two other incentives I think we can mention in terms of existing houses, not necessarily 50 years or older houses, but there's a provision that provides for a one-time 250 square foot addition every 5 years for a house that's existing, meaning it's been around for at least 5 years. So you could be up and above the FAR limit and still get a small increment of addition in this period of time. So that provides a little premium. And secondly, there is a provision that allows for doing a property line adjustment for those historically narrow lots to create a flag lot behind an existing house if you're retaining the existing house. So as a way to discourage demolition and replacement of that house, they can retain their house and through a rather inexpensive and faster property line adjustment process, create another fee simple lot behind their house. So the second item that was brought up was related to cottage clusters and their compatibility or potential incompatibility with historic districts. And I think it's just worth a reminder or mention that cottage clusters is a branding of an existing plan development process that already exists. What we have done with this project is provide for accessory dwelling units to be added with those detached, what we would all otherwise call houses if they have property lines between them. So we've sort of fixed a little foible in the code that now allows for those accessory dwelling units. We've added some criteria that speak to common open area, open space, and some pedestrian circulation standards. But by and large, the existing process for the PD, which includes looking at neighborhood compatibility, as well as within a historic district, would have historic resource review applied. Those existing criterion reviews would continue to be applied. Ben mentioned the switch to the hearings officer, which is an interesting twist, but I think by and large, most of these are going to be 10 unit type plan developments. So mostly a staff level type decision. There was also the mention about the two detached ADUs and a desire by the commission to allow for potentially those ADUs to be combined in a single building. When I reviewed the code this morning, I wasn't finding an answer to that, but we talked with our code editor and we have determined that the way the code is currently written, it doesn't allow for two ADUs to be attached, two detached ADUs to be attached to one another. Otherwise, they somewhat become treated like a duplex. There are some issues and concerns about that approach that we would want to explore a little bit further before going down the route of creating this sort of new housing type that doesn't exist in our code yet. And for example, if we were talking about a 1,000-square-foot primary house that had two 750 square foot ADUs attached to each other, we're now talking about a 1,000 square foot primary structure with a 1,500 square foot accessory structure. So it's not to say that there aren't situations that could work, but I think it deserves a little more exploration and a little more testing, which we didn't do, and we don't have that in our proposal. So just to make you aware of that.
Jump in. The next item on our list, and Ben highlighted it, has to do with the language around additions. And Chair Ranzetta, I think, asked a question about how often do we see additions that are 800 square feet or doubling the footprint size of a building. Today, those types of additions are allowed. We don't have a restriction saying thou shall not build 800 square foot additions. What this language is seeking to do is to say, if you are choosing, you are electing to take advantage of the historic preservation incentives because you're a historic landmark or historic district, conservation landmark or in a conservation district, or a rank structure on the HRI, you are eligible to take advantage of those incentives, but you may not do an addition larger than that size to take advantage of the incentive, and you still have to meet whatever the applicable historic resource review or community design standard would be. So it's not to say that you're exempt from historic resource review, it's to say that if you're not going through historic resource review, you would have those parameters put upon you. And part of that is because if you're a historic resource inventory property today, the only regulation that applies to that type of resource is a 4-month demolition delay period. So in the code today, we're not restricting what someone can and can't do with that property other than having a demolition delay. We didn't want to give an opportunity to so severely alter an HRI property that it no longer retained its significance. And so we wanted to put some level of parameter on how big of an addition one could do if they're seeking to use these incentives. And if they were seeking to do a project that could not meet those standards, that there was a path that they could voluntarily go through historic resource review and come to staff or to this commission to get approval through the discretionary process. You still would be able to, if you're an HRI resource and you're adding one ADU, or you're a single family homeowner and you want to, you know, severely alter that resource, if you're not taking advantage of those additional housing opportunity incentives, you would be able to do that without any type of review or standard applied, other than the height and FAR limits. And for the HRI structures, it's our professional judgment that there's not a lot we can do prior to them being designated to regulate those properties. However, if a property owner is electing to take advantage of an incentive in the code, then we believe we can apply additional standards to doing that.
And so finally, well, not finally, second to finally, this commission didn't support encouraging the standards that essentially encourage tuck under garages, and we heard that from you and others. So we've, like I mentioned, we've removed those standards, and now for narrow lots, we are prohibiting that parking situation. But I should underline or underscore the fact that tuck unders are still permissible for lots that are wider than 32 feet. So where people elect to provide parking, and it's not a narrow lot, a tuck under may still be one of those garage solutions that they propose.
And I think the last thing that we had on your list from November was some concern about both the concern about setbacks, both allowing additional setback or additional protrusion into the setback for eaves and other elements that protrude from the building into the side setback, and then as well as the front setback. So to address those first point, the commission told us you were concerned about 2-foot eaves projecting into the side setbacks. Today we allow setback 1-foot projection into those side setbacks. We're proposing to allow a larger encroachment into that setback for eaves in those situations where architecturally it makes sense for a house to have a deeper eave, and to allow for things like contextual responses to neighboring properties if a property owner so chooses. And that is something that was one of a small handful of items that the Stakeholder Advisory Committee for this project told us that they would like property owners to have the flexibility to do. Again, this commission, if there were a project in a historic district, either the commission or staff would review that project for compatibility. If it was not appropriate in a historic district to do a 2-foot eave into a setback, then that would be addressed through historic resource review. Another piece had to do with the front setback. The commission asked for, I think you said, both flexibility and requirements in the same sentence. We were a little confused as to flexibility requirement, but essentially I think the commission was asking for more contextual front setbacks. And what we have in the proposed draft is similar to the discussion draft, where in the R5 zone, we are increasing the front setback 50% more than it is today. So we're moving to a 15-foot front setback, but we're allowing that front setback to be reduced if you're matching one of the neighboring properties. So if you're in the South Portland Historic District, where front setbacks might be 3 or 5 feet on a street, you can come into that front setback to match an adjacent property. But generally, because we're trying to set citywide rules, we picked 15 feet as the minimum. Again, if you're in historic resource review and you're on a street where the average front setback is 18 feet, historic resource review could still require that house to be set back further if it's matching the context in a historic district. And the other piece I was going to say, and Morgan, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the R2.5 zone, even though the proposed draft is not recommending a 15-foot setback, we're recommending keeping the existing 10-foot setback. That setback matching would still exist if you were in a Buckman or Northwest Portland, where the front setback may be less on the neighboring properties.
So that's basically a quick summary, kind of given the time constraints. So if there are specific questions, we can try to resolve, or things that you're not clear about, we can try to resolve that. Otherwise, I'm probably gonna have to head out.
One thing I'll say too is for why we're here today. Morgan mentioned this, and I want to remind everyone of it, is that the Planning and Sustainability Commission will be having their hearings on May 8th and May 15th. Those are the two opportunities for testimony and responding to the proposed draft. At this point, the Planning and Sustainability Commission will hold hearings and have deliberations and ultimately make a recommendation to City Council. And so the elements that this commission may still feel strongly about, either in support or opposed, would be good to bring to the Planning and Sustainability Commission at one of those hearings, and probably in a letter, since there is a significant volume of testimony that will be received on this. And I would encourage you both to identify those things that you support and those things that you have concerns about.
Could I ask a technical question? Oh, this is Wendy Chung, by the way. I've joined the proceeding. You are talking about the HRI and ranked properties versus our ask that 50 years and older be identified. And I think what I heard you say was that if they were ranked on the HRI or they were designated specifically, then they would be eligible for the incentives. With the historic code project that you're working on, won't there no longer be ranked properties on the HRI? Like, won't they all be sort of, I thought we were getting rid of the rankings.
Yeah, so Commissioner Chung is asking sort of a master's level question on this. We have been advised that for future survey and inventory work, rankings are not the best practice way to evaluate significance. That in the future, we likely would use just a binary determination of significance, so it is or is not significant. In our current working draft of the code, we're proposing to fold everything that's ranked into a determination of significance. So if you're ranked today, you might be significant tomorrow. We just may use a different language for future survey inventory. For this project, we would be able to accommodate that change so that things that were ranked in 1984 would be considered significant in the future, unless a new survey said that they were not.
And in terms of timing, this will happen before the new survey is obviously before the new survey is complete. So there is still a chance that we would have undesignated or unidentified resources that could, not be avail themselves to some of these incentives.
Certainly. Right?
Okay.
And looking too at what the incentives get you, the incentives aren't getting you cash. They're not getting you a huge additional development opportunity. They give you generally on-site flexibility for where you put your units, and allowing for larger detached structures in the backyard than may otherwise be the case, in hopes that, especially for those resources that will not come before this commission, that we give enough site flexibility, even if it's not perfect from a historic resource review perspective, to entice owners into preserving their HRI resources rather than scraping the site and building new.
Thank you.
So I have a thread or I don't know if it's really a question, but when you talked about the first time sort of creating the A overlay and that was going to apply, even in historic zones. I mean, it's basically across the entire east side of Portland, which is where our older housing stock is predominantly, as well as older, kind of nodes. I get that transportation is better, all of these sort of issues that, were used to sort of apply the A overlay. But I still do have to say that there's a significant level of concern that some of these policies are going to create some real changes in areas outside of historic districts that are, potentially eligible to be historic district or at least to have their character eroded. And one of them, which is probably not a huge issue for me, is just the visitability. While I get that, it also is going to ensure that, there are new houses built without really a visible base. And, unfortunate, I can see why, I mean, I guess I'm sort of willing to concede on that one. But one that I'm still really just struggling with is the sort of pushing of the cottage cluster idea across this east side area. I mean, I could understand the cottage cluster pattern being pushed kind of in the very deep lots in East Portland, you know, further out, because those areas don't really have a defined sort of street presence. And so I guess I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you, really, what problem is being solved by encouraging cottage clusters when we already have things like garden court apartment, you know, historic models that work better in historic areas?
Well, so, and those historic models will still be allowed. Again, through plan development, you can do that multi-dwelling structure today in a single dwelling zone through plan development. It's interesting, the cottage cluster proposal took on a little bit of a life of its own in terms of enthusiasm for it. It is, I would not characterize it as a true cottage cluster code, meaning that we didn't attempt to develop a streamlined standards process for it. It's still a discretionary review. Plan development incorporates all the elements of how it appears to the street, how it appears to the surrounding neighborhood, includes that discretion. And it's also, unlike the provisions in the A that provide for three units on a lot, you don't really get any extra density out of the cottage cluster. You're getting essentially what you could have gotten if you just did a standard subdivision, meaning with those property lines, now you can have an ADU with each of those houses. So there's not a density incentive there. It's more of a process leveling the playing field that we put into this proposal. So
leveling the playing field for who?
Well, if you wanted to go through and create a 10 lot subdivision with 10 ADUs and put property lines in, that's a type 2 process. If you wanted to do the same thing and not have those property lines, it'd be a type 3 process. So in terms of that level of process, we put them on the same playing field. The subdivision, plan development, AKA cottage cluster-ish kind of thing. So it's not a full bore cottage cluster incentive program. We did add some criteria around common open space, trying to emulate what we've seen at the better parts of cottage clusters. To date, there aren't that many in the city, probably half dozen or fewer.
Right.
I think they're an interesting development concept, but I'm not sure that the demand is there, or at least the developer's willingness is there. So that's a little bit to see what plays out. I think there's some positive aspects that can be designed for particular types of inhabitants. They can be age-friendly design. They could be made to model more historic kind of micro neighborhood kind of settings, but it all has to be done with care, and you can't develop standards for that. So we sort of pulled back and left it as a discretionary review.
Hmm. We may keep going on cottage clusters, but I want to go back to the visitability. I know Morgan has to leave before I do.
Sure.
But Morgan, really quick to respond to Kristen's question about visitability. But existing structure still exempt from meeting the visitability requirement, A? And B, the visitability requirement is for one unit in your multi-unit development. So for example, if you're in Irvington and you're converting your house into a basement ADU, mm-hmm. Under the proposed draft, you could do that and max out the size of that basement and not have that be a visitable unit. And you could convert your existing garage, maybe with an alteration or addition, to a visitable unit, and you wouldn't be required, since it's an existing structure, to make it visitable, but it would work really well to be visitable because you're an existing visitable type garage. So thinking about places like Irvington or some of our other sort of inner pattern areas, it could make a lot of sense for those detached ADUs to be no step, since that would be part of the sort of the typical form of the detached garage or detached structure being at grade to start with.
Okay.
I have a pointed follow-up question, if I may, about the cottage cluster, since you have you're short on time, so I figured I'd let you go out with a bang. You mentioned that a developer is very enthusiastic and that, but that this is really just a, you know, you just want to see how it plays out. Is there a precedent in our code writing or quasi-legislative activities where we promote a particular type of development on behalf of a developer who's enthusiastic? I hope not. I would think not, right? I mean, we don't write stuff like that into the code just to see how it plays out in order to, you know, assuage concerns of an enthusiastic developer.
No, right? I think my point was more that we have there is an existing cottage cluster provision in our code that we've refined somewhat, and we haven't fully renovated or retrofitted or created a fast path track for approval for a particular developer or development type. It's an existing thing. We've adjusted the review process to be consistent with what we do for subdivisions. And perhaps by saying we want to see how it plays out is kind of being a little too blasé. There are existing controls in the plan development process, and there are criteria that have to be met. So how it plays out, someone will submit an application, and then it gets reviewed. Conditions can be attached to it. Architecture is reviewed. It's actually a pretty high bar in comparison to a standard subdivision where you just bank the lots and walk away from it. So, it's not like an uncontrolled lab experiment. It's more of a refinement on our existing processes.
So, and I'm sorry, I came late and here I am like hammering you on this, but I just want to better understand. Are we getting more density out of this cottage cluster thing? It sounds like it's already in the code. It sounds like we already have subdivisions. It sounds like really there's nothing other than promoting a particular type of architecture or development. But if it's actually increasing density, which I thought was the purpose of this in some way, then that's different. But is it going to increase density? I mean, you mentioned earlier that there are very few. It's very unlikely that we're going to have very many of these.
So the cottage cluster proposal applies inside, outside of the A overlay, inside, outside of the R25, R5, R7 zones. So it's more universal. In terms of its additional density, the big change here is because, this is going to get really in the weeds, when you have more than one detached house on a lot, it's considered detached multi-dwelling development structures. It's not so catchy, but they look like houses, but based on the way they're defined in the code, they're not houses, and an ADU is only allowed currently with a house. So the only way to get an ADU now is to have a house on its own lot, separated from any other house. As soon as you get two houses on a lot, you're out of luck. So the plan development change is, if they're detached primary structures, i.e. houses, they are now allowed to have an ADU where they weren't allowed before. So overall, the density increase is not, it's marginal. It's the same as if someone went through a subdivision. So it's something, it kind of brings them up to where they would be if they did a subdivision, but it's not the sort of additional housing types of allowing duplexes and triplexes that we're talking about within that overlay.
Got it, thank you.
Yeah.
I have one more quick question. Yeah. It sort of relates to what you touched on, and it's sort of the idea of unintended consequences. And one I'm thinking similar to the requirement of accessibility and not having raised porches is the height change. And, you know, are we going to incentivize a lot of flat roofs where is there a way to allow for a pitched roof to be a little taller than a flat? Because I'm seeing a lot of flat roofs, and I'm thinking that this change is going to actually make it where there's a more of an incentive to.
Yeah, I think there is a likelihood of that. There's a couple things. The exclusion for attic space is tied to a low attic ceiling height, so you don't get a whole lot of lift by providing that gable before you start counting the floor area in that sort of half story. So that's a sort of disincentive for a gable roof. The lower height limit also can tend to disincent gable roofs. Is there a way to do it differently? Probably.
It touches just on, you know, we don't know exactly what's going to happen until we test this, and smart people are going to apply these rules in a way that benefits them as much financially as they can. And so, you know, another one I think of is when you talk about the scale of houses, it's really the size of the living area. Mm-hmm. But if we pack three of those together, we end up with a structure that is, for all intents and purposes, the same size as the big monster houses that we're trying to regulate out.
So
from a streetscape sort of just experience, won't three 2,500 square foot houses look like?
No. Okay. So this is an important distinction. So on your first point, the application of FAR on single dwelling structures is, it's fairly groundbreaking. I mean, other cities have done it. We reviewed a number of different codes, but how it plays out in our local climate and local architecture, we have yet to see. I mean, we've seen examples of homes that comply with it, but as people try to figure out the most economical way to utilize their existing or their FAR allowance, we'll see how that plays out.
It may end up that you achieve the goal of more, you know, more diverse, affordable, smaller houses, but we may end up with visually still these monsters. And
right.
I guess
so,
that's the point I'm trying to make.
So recall, there is a process to revisit our code. If there are adjustments that are needed, you know, we can do that through a subsequent recap project. But the big point I wanted to make is that when we're talking about the duplex or triplex structures, it's not two or three times the size of what we're granting for a house. It's the easiest example is a 5,000 square foot lot, 2,500 square foot house, or 5,000 square foot lot, 2,500 square foot duplex, each unit being 1,250.
Oh, I see. Okay. Right. Okay.
Triplex gets a little differently because you take that detached structure and you add it onto your primary structure house triplex size. But
I apologize. I probably could have gotten that if I'd have paid a little.
No, that's fine. I think a lot of people make that mistake, and it's, I can see where the concern starts emulating, because we're, when we show the example of different house sizes in the city, and the largest house you can build on a 5,000 square foot lot is about 6,700 square feet, we also say nobody's building that house. The biggest house is about 4,400 square feet, but we have seen duplexes at 6,200 square feet, or, you know, 2,000-3,000 square foot units tied together. So when we're talking about duplexes out in the neighborhoods, people are thinking of those and not thinking of something that just looks like this house with two doors on it.
Okay. And Matthew, one more thing. I want to respond with the height, the flat roof question. Earlier in the process, we heard from many people that new houses were too high, too tall. And our previous or current height measurement is from the high point. We're proposing to change that to the low point. And so for some projects, that may not drastically change the scale. But especially for those projects that do a tuck under garage or a basement service entry that would pull down that measurement point to something lower, I think it'd be likely that'll change the roof form. And I, for example, walking around Irvington, there are many houses that would be too tall, or, you know, we could not rebuild that situation tomorrow if we measure height from the low point, because that gable roof is too drastic. It would need to be a flat roof.
You can rebuild if it's accidentally destroyed, though.
Next door.
Related to that, one last question. So when I first moved to Portland in the early 90s, a lot of the large homes in Northwest Portland were converted into apartments. Are people going to convert those back to large homes, and is that going to be allowed to take basically what is currently a divided up, formerly single family house, and reconvert it back to a single family house?
I think it's largely dependent on the underlying zone. So in some multi-dwelling zones, you have a minimum density requirement. Single dwelling zones, we do have a number of duplexes that are getting converted to single dwelling houses. Duplexes that are getting converted to single dwelling houses in part for financing, that it's easier to finance a single house than a duplex, which is interesting. And there's nothing in the proposal that prevents you from going one way or the other.
It's just options. A supply and demand thing, because we're going to limit the supply of the existing very large homes. And
that's, yeah.
But maybe that's good.
But why not put something in the code that prevents that?
The backsliding, so if you've created a duplex, you can't go back?
Well, just because if we're trying to increase density and we're, you know, encouraging more duplexes and triplexes, we wouldn't want people to reduce the existing number that we have out there, right? It would offset. I mean, I don't know. Has that any thought been given to that?
Well, at this point, I think a little bit of it is because we're still talking about a single dwelling zone. We're trying to provide for options for people to do something beyond a single dwelling, but not restrict people from having a single dwelling. But
what about an incentive to retain a multi-dwelling if it's already multi-dwelling? I don't know what that would be, but I think Commissioner Roman's right. I think that there would be, to your point, that, you know, financing considerations with all kinds of reasons why we wouldn't want to accidentally lose some of those units. I don't know, just a thought.
Parking requirements, maybe?
Yeah, know. Parking requirements.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. They have to go put a parking spot back.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, good.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? Sorry to bolt, but I, got other,
code right.
Other duties. Yeah. Thank you again.
So it was a matter of next steps. We could do what we did last time, have staff coordinate getting your written testimony put together for submittal to the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Assuming that the Landmarks Commission would like to submit testimony in the first place, I believe that you will. And then also coordinating who and how and when you could submit in-person testimony at one or both of those hearings in May.
May 8th and 15th.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And I think they're in the evening, so I will take a look right now.
Is it in the afternoon?
He's checking the time right now.
It's like May 8th this evening and May
8th. Is your mic on, Brandon?
Hold on, but both evenings.
Two Tuesdays in a row.
Yep.
And Ben here has taken some pretty good notes that could be a jumping off point for.
We also have your old memo, which sounds like a lot of the issues might still be valid, which we could work to tweak.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think I still have concerns about the 50%.
Yeah.
Alterations, just providing that allowance makes people think that that's what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's the same with the height.
Right.
So just ascribing a percentage to it, you know, seems to give people an invested right. percentage of what they can do. And so when somebody limits that through our discretionary review, it just blows back. Either staff or us.
Yeah. And you'll have to take a look at that specific section of code. We thought we made it pretty clear that it, if it's subject to a historic resource review, that takes control.
That's just regardless of what's in the code. I mean,
that's right for the overlay.
Yeah, that's more of a perception thing than a code writing thing.
I agree, though, that by adding the 50%, it just creates another perception of entitlement beyond whatever's already
right,
there.
Right, that just could just serve to erode our
right.
the opportunity for discretionary review when the legislature comes back
right.
and says, you know, people want to be able to do the 50%, and they're not being able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, why put a percentage
exactly.
if it's up to the Design
objective.
Commission, Landmarks Commission, whoever.
And that was generally for those things that would never have made it, that are not subject to review. So HRI property or in a conservation district where it already has community design standards, and then owner can do those things today, and tomorrow would still be able to do those things unless they're adding that extra housing unit. And there may be a better way to do that, and I think that advice would be taken to heart. But part of the thinking was it really geared the thinking was going the opposite direction, I think, as your concerns of let's make sure that those resources that don't make it through historic resource review have there's something that'll catch them from being too drastic a change. And maybe that's still too drastic, and that'd be great feedback. But the thought was, wherever we could, how do we make sure that change is not so detrimental to the resource if someone chooses to do these things in areas where we can't apply stronger regulation due to their undesignated status. But yeah, if you have a better number, those would be great things to hear.
Yeah, I don't know if I could ascribe a percentage to it.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah, a number.
Not really.
I think we should get away from numbers because I think it, like I said, I think if you put 25 or 40% or whatever you put, it's going to be viewed as an entitlement because otherwise, why would you have gone to the trouble of ascribing a specific number?
Right. Yeah, I agree. And I think I still just have, you know, lingering concerns about the infill project and the incentives that are being provided. I'm not sure if they're going to be robust enough to really make much of a difference. I think it'll be on a profoundly individual basis where that incentive will be beneficial for a resource. And I think that given the fact the city has not updated its HRI in decades is unfortunately going to leave a lot in the landfill. And I don't think I've heard, I mean, I've looked through the staff report, I've looked through a little bit of the code and just tried to understand the impact, and ultimately the impact is unpredictable because of the market. And even all the reassurances about displacement and you know, of the people who will be there that are an intimate part of some of these historic neighborhoods are ultimately subject to the marketplace as opposed to the equity of having the A overlay over everywhere. I mean, the unfortunate thing is that the market will impact people regardless of who's there, but they'll more than likely impact the cheapest housing because that's the most viable opportunity for density.
And the smallest.
Thus, not only removing the more affordable units, but making housing more expensive. And
we're losing more of that middle, you know, middle housing option.
Right.
So.
Right. And I just, I want to believe that that density can be employed in a different way, somehow. But I mean, when you look at the historical periods of when the massive displacements have occurred, they've occurred with the best of intentions. That, you know, the Rose Quarter will be this economic driver, the Lloyd Center will be this economic driver, I-5 will be a huge benefit. And all you see is this just subtraction of the city's most affordable housing just going away, even the South Auditorium. I mean, when you really look at the cumulative impact of all that, housing is just pushed out ultimately. So
I share your concern. I think on some level we're already dealing with it. I mean, I'm seeing, you know, houses bought for $300,000 torn down and new houses built, single family houses. And so when you say, well, now you can tear that one down and you can build two, and even though they're smaller, each one of those is gonna
be way more than
that 300, whatever they bought. And that, yeah, sorry, I am, but that didn't include the demo too. So they paid that for the lot with the house, then they had to demo the house. So that's the lot price in Southeast Portland right now.
And think about like the environmental impact of that, right? Like all that, besides the embedded energy for the building that was destroyed, you know, you're putting all that stuff into the air, and then we were talking about that previously, and then you're building two new things, and then it puts pressure against either the design commission or us to make sure that these things are compatible.
Well, I'd say globally it wouldn't fall on either of us because most of this stuff has no design review at all. This is just completely prescriptive, you know, you met the base requirements and we don't actually look at what it looks like. We don't
get to opine about that. It's not, pretty much written
not in residential. Yeah, it's unfortunate.
Not outside the districts, yeah. Yeah.
And I'll share some of the the DRAC subcommittee because it kind of relates to this and the idea of what we're going to define as demolition. But I think there were inspectors and planners who acknowledged that the only way you're really going to address this is to have a design overlay zone for the whole city, and they don't see that ever happening. So basically, the meeting I went to, that, and I'll just jump into it a little bit because I think it relates, is we spent 2 hours discussing what the definition of demolition would be. Oh, and at the end, it was all the walls had to be gone. So, you know, 100%, 95% is not demolition. And that starts to relate to what we talk about when we think 1916 or older needs to be dismantled. Not if they leave one little wall, because then it's not a demolition. And so technically they've gotten out of that hole. So it's to the life safety issue, the dust. And I don't want to be negative. I'm just passing along the crux of the problem is, you know, they've sort of broken it into three categories: the life safety issue of what demolition is, what's being demolished, and then what's getting put back in its place. And they really only want to deal with the life safety part of it, because all the rest of it, I think, is too difficult to manage. And so when like the neighbors, there's a bunch of these neighborhood activist groups that have been invited to participate as well. And they're arguing for, well, maybe 50% of the walls, more than 50%, it should be considered demolition. And the planners are suggesting, well, how do we even quantify that? So you're getting into process of, well, if someone comes in, how do we measure? Is it linear footage? You know, if we keep 50, do we get to modify that 50, or does that 50 have to stay exactly the way it is? I don't envy them, because it's a terribly complex situation, but it seems to get mixed up into some of what we're talking about in terms of the inventory and incentivizing the demolition of single-family houses for duplexes or triplexes.
Well, I mean, that's the other thing, is that the assumption is that it would be replaced by a duplex, but it won't. At the end of the day, that's not a guarantee. There are some, again, incentives for it to happen, but I think people can point to a lot of examples of one-to-ones.
Right.
So,
Brendan, do you know if there's been any discussion of moving along the SDC waivers idea as an incentive?
I'm glad you mentioned it. It's on my short list here that I wanted to bring up. I do know Commissioner Hugh Daly's office had expressed interest in permanently extending the SDC waiver for accessory dwelling units. My understanding is today that SDC waiver is valued at somewhere around $15,000 to $18,000 per ADU. So if not for the waiver, it would cost $15,000 to $18,000 more to build an ADU. Our research from, I think, 2016, maybe 2017, had shown that something like 93% of ADUs built that year were in conjunction with an existing house. So generally, ADUs are being built in conjunction with an existing house. Generally, that waiver is helping make them viable for a property owner who may not have the cash on hand or equity to do it without some level of subsidy. The commissioner's office is, as I understand it, interested in extending that waiver. I do not know where that discussion is at, but it is probably the most powerful financial incentive for adding density and keeping houses that we at the city at least have yet to employ. So it's something to think about. And it would be timely, since that waiver expires on July 1st.
Okay. I mean, I think we would strongly support that, especially as used, you know, in conjunction with an existing house. I'm really far less interested in supporting it if it's part of a cottage cluster where you already have a tiny, you know, proliferation of little inefficient structures, and then you're going to add more sheds.
Is that the same thing as a slab town village? Are you guys aware of the slab town village? There's a
Where's that one?
It's on Petty. No, it's on Marshall or Northrop or Overton, one of those, and 19th, and it's a cluster of tiny homes that recently popped up. I'm just wondering if that's what we're talking about here. Is that a cottage cluster? I mean, it's literally on a quarter block, and there's like six of them.
I don't know.
With the cottage cluster, the property is divided, right?
No, according to Marshall, it sounds like it's not divided. It's all in one.
So it's like a condo?
yeah.
kind of well, situation?
There's sometimes separate units that are, you know, not connected to each other, but will have a common kitchen area or some kind of common space.
Anyway, like
there's a book called Pocket Neighborhoods that recently came out from an architect up in Moody Island. It's sort of a vogue part of the communal sort of living, shared living type. I don't think of it as much in the city and yeah. urban fabric as I do
it's
in a sort of a model of
totally not urban.
Yeah. So, but.
I did have a quick question. I wasn't quite sure if I understood all this correctly, but it sounds like there are incentives in here to encourage people with historic homes, which are what's listed on page 28, which is this list of, right? So anything that's on this list has incentives for not demolishing. And then one of the things we asked in our letter was to consider applying incentives to anything over 50 years old, correct? That was what we were asking for, those incentives to apply to any building over 50 years old. It sounds like that didn't get in, correct? So
we did that with the parking. So we took the parking incentive to say if you're adding that third unit or converting your house to a duplex, that you would no longer be required to have on-site parking. We extended that to anything that's 5 years or older. So
that's what you were saying, for 5 years and older. But this issue of, which is the concern that people are going to start demolishing their building, and the benefit of adding way more buildings that have that incentive to keep. And I'm just curious, was that something that was really, that's what I understand we were asking for, correct? And was that ever discussed?
I would take a look at, incentive may be the wrong language here. The only real benefit you now get if you're historic is to move the FAR around the site. So if that in your mind qualifies as an incentive, then I think it's good language to keep using. I'm not sure
so that, really
that
is the
providing
only...
that to other properties would really be, well, I should say moving the FAR and the units around the site. You can have much more site flexibility for where you put your units and your FAR if you're historic than if you're not. But we did take what the commission said to heart, for better or worse, and apply that parking flexibility, which was previously just for designated historic everywhere. And we took the flexibility for larger than allowed ADUs in the basement and gave those to everybody who's already existing too. So
okay.
in a way, we've tried to balance are there things we can do to encourage someone to seek designation? You know, are there things that are unique to designated or significant resources inventory to entice someone into that?
Right.
That area, balancing that with, but we want to keep these existing buildings that are viable and functional, keep them around. So should we extend the incentives there? And the debate internally has been, do we hoard for the capital H historic stuff, the flexibility and the additional FAR housing parking opportunities, or do we make them broadly available? And what's the outcome? I think the one thing that really has weighed on us internally as it pertains to who gets incentives is that if you're a designated historic resource, you're not tearing that building down to build a duplex or a triplex. And that is so different than the way we're treating everything that's not historic. And so we've been kind of talking about it as an incentive, but if you're in Irvington and you're a contributing building, the RIP project will not put any additional pressure on the demolition of those buildings. Or at least the thought is, if it's designated either as a landmark, conservation landmark, or contributing structure in a historic or conservation district, this RIP A overlay will not put pressure on those buildings for demolition. It may put pressure on demolition elsewhere, but we really wanted to ensure that the additional housing opportunities were not at odds with preservation of those structures. And so the way the proposed draft reads is, if you're one of those designated resources, you may not demolish it or go through demolition delay and then take advantage of an incentive. Or sorry, take advantage of the additional housing. So,
but if it's a non-contributing in Irvington, for instance, right?
You
it would incentivize demolition of those homes as well as anything that's yet to be designated because our HRI is woefully out of date. Essentially,
our economic report tells us that it may or may not be incentivizing depending on how large the structure is, what geography it's in, how it's used today. But we did not extend that prohibition beyond designated and contributing because we felt like, A, those were the right resources to ensure that we protect, and B, with the HRI resources, we didn't think we could do that because they're not designated.
Right, because they're not designated. But to be clear, the designated ones, we already have historic protection around contributing structures and landmarks and things in historic districts. So whether or not there was this RIP project, those resources would be protected. It's just that what you're saying is that this isn't putting additional pressure because they continue to be protected under like the type four there or whatever needs to go through if they were to be demolished, right?
I'd go a lot further than that. The type four is just a process. Mm-hmm. So city council can decide on today's makeup of the council what's more important, a duplex or a contributing building.
Right.
And they have that power to decide duplex. The way that the RIP project has been written is it does not provide the opportunity for someone to ask the question. Like, you cannot go to city council to ask for a type four demo review to replace the building with a duplex. So it removes from the option list the option to go to council and demolish to build a duplex. However, you can convert that house to a duplex. You can add a backyard ADU. You could add two backyard ADUs. You can still do those housing choices, but you can't go to city council and say, I want to demolish this to build a duplex.
How often has that happened? Has anybody asked to demolish go through a type four to demolish a single building, put in a duplex?
I would say it hasn't happened, but in part because the zoning code today doesn't allow those duplexes or triplexes. So we're introducing a new use allowed.
So you're basically mitigating the risk that you created by, and I'm not picking on you.
That's a good way to phrase it. That's a really good way to phrase it.
You know, you and I are usually like on the same page. I'm not trying to pick on you either, but basically this, what you're doing is you're mitigating the harm that you've introduced into the circumstance. Not you, but you know, BPS basically.
That would be a great way. I think I might say, you know, because these are goal five historic resources, we're wanting to ensure that the A overlay doesn't, that it's compatible with our preservation intentions of those resources.
Got it. Thank you.
It just would somehow be nice, just putting it out there, to create some sort of incentive again to those 50-year plus to make it some benefit to be considered 50-year plus so that there isn't that desire to be like, well, whatever, it's not on anything, so let's just replace it. When in fact, They may very well be a lot of buildings out there that are worth keeping and would be nice to keep, and the neighbors want to keep, and so it would just be nice to have an extra incentive. And I don't know if that's possible. But
I think your letter to the Planning Commission would be a great opportunity to delineate those things. In large part, unless we're talking about dollars, we've kind of come up short on what those would look like, or I should say, where we thought we came up with good ideas, they've been more broadly applied to everybody. When
right.
They've taken off. But the SDC waiver, I would say, is like, if that's an important one for you for ADUs, I think we've seen it work really well for encouraging additional density and the retention of a house.
Not to change topics, but real fast, do you foresee the city advocating for a rehabilitation tax credit? I mean, obviously, the city doesn't have that power, but in terms of lobbying the legislature for something like that in order to facilitate.
That's a great question. I've had a number of meetings over the last couple of weeks about that very question. And the general consensus of what I've heard is that the 2019 legislative session is unlikely to have the dollars to spend to create a tax credit.
That makes sense. They don't have any money.
Even if the city had a strong interest in that, there's a question in Salem about are there resources, and B, how could they be applied? There have been some other ideas about potential funding sources in Salem that may be interim. One is, we know that the special assessment program is set to sunset if not renewed next legislative session. We know that the Speaker of the House's office has created a Main Street Rehabilitation Grant Program. Maybe one of those programs could be continued to be more broadly applied for these types of projects.
Tim? Any other questions?
So who would like to contribute to the letter? Well, do you want to take initial go just from our previous one and just add the concerns?
I think a lot of my initial draft will consist of your last letter with some tweaks. And I'm happy to do that.
Okay. Do we have a short list of people who would like to see that draft?
I'll work on it. I'm going to be out of town May 8th and possibly May 15th. I'm not positive.
Okay.
Yeah, I would like to help work on it as well. I'm going to be out of town for a week. I mean, I have a deadline at the end of this week, and then the next week I'm out of town. So I have very, very limited time. But I'll work on it, you know, in the evening at some point while I'm gone. If, you know, sure. I'll check my emails and just commit. We got it with our pocket.
Yeah. I can send you a digital copy as well.
And I'm happy to help too.
I'm sorry.
I just thought I'd volunteer. Maybe we have enough, but if anybody,
it'd be nice to have someone who's in town.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm definitely.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have to respond to that because May 14th is our retreat, and so I'm hoping that you're here because you said you would be here. Okay. I thought May 14th is a Monday.
14th is a Monday. The 15th.
Is that the date of the...
No, May 15th. No, it's the 8th or the 15th. Are the.
He's leaving right after the retreat.
I am flying back to Boston the day before our retreat, and Natalie trying to get from Seattle down here in time. But I'm going to do it.
See? Hillary?
And I was going to say. We can coordinate having testimony at the PSC with three members of our subcommittee or potentially additional members. Chair Ranzetta, might be good to get your testimony or testimony from all seven commissioners.
In person?
In person. That could be powerful. So okay. We can work that out.
What do y'all think?
What was that would have been? I'm so sorry. What date?
The
May 8th and May 15th.
Both days? We want us all there, or one or the other? Or we?
I think we'd only need each of you to testify probably once, but it might be nice to have representatives at both hearings.
The 15th.
That 8th is out. The 15th, I might be able to. Do.
I could do 15th. I couldn't do the 8th, but yeah.
I can do the 8th, but I could do 15th.
Sounds like it's the 15th.
Okay.
And we can strategize dividing up topics and figuring out your testimony as
and wearing matching outfits.
Do you have any additional concerns that we haven't talked about today, or is kind of your?
I think you hit all the topics you've talked about before. I didn't see anything new that jumped out at me as being a significant concern. We're still working on our staff level review, and that'll be completed by the end of this week, so we'll have a better sense once I've gotten Hillary's comments and other planners' comments collated and sorted through. But I'm not anticipating anything significant.
I think from internal at BPS, you know, we've put this forward as our proposal for the Planning and Sustainability Commission, recognizing there are a number of items for discussion. And Commissioner Roman, your observation that the height measurement and the FAR calculation of exempt basements may lead to flat roofs, I think is an item of conversation for your fellow commissioners and your letter, because it would appear as though a likely outcome is a tuck under garage and flat roof scenario.
it'd be fun to test the new code to see how ugly of a building I could possibly design and still meet it.
Although I was thinking it'd be nice to have like a test area for just a year, just to see how it's applied, you know? Exactly.
We can bring in a model.
People come up with crazy things. They're pretty inventive.
Maybe we could figure out where the planning and sustainability commissioners live and then propose that be the test area.
I do, and all joking aside, I do think we need to be prepared for the Planning and Sustainability Commission not necessarily endorsing all the historic elements, even limited as they are.
Absolutely.
I fully anticipate.
I wouldn't go into that too lightly as though they're all in agreement with us. So.
Okay, I will send out the previous letter to Commissioner Minor, Commissioner Roman, and Commissioner Chung. And just for your reference, I have a digital copy. And then I'll start drafting a revision based on that letter and try to get that to you ASAP.
Good man, Ben.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
thank you for doing that.
Sure.
Two things.
Yep.
I have the draft